Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today I'm going to look at a recent episode of the show Last Week Tonight with alleged comedian John Oliver. His special was on transgender issues, with an emphasis on issues involving children, like co-ed sports and banning so-called gender-affirming surgery for minors. So, three things before we continue. First, I'm not going to talk about theological issues in this rebuttal, because Oliver never brings any of that up. But I'm hoping to do an episode on Catholic theology and transgender issues in the future. For now, I cover some of that in my book, Made This Way, co-authored with my friend Layla Miller. So check that out if you want my thoughts on what the church teaches on transgender issues. Second, I'm not going to cover everything in Oliver's original video. I've edited out some of the jokes and other tangents that aren't relevant to the central arguments that he's making. Finally, in preparing this episode, I watched other responses from Matt Walsh, Michael Knowles, Steven Crowder, and I hope what I say in this video will be a helpful complement to their rebuttals. Now, with that said, let's take a look at John Oliver on so-called trans rights.
We're going to talk about transgender rights. Now, we actually first talked about this 7 years ago, and the good news is that since then, more people do seem comfortable coming out as trans and gender non-conforming, which is great. But, as you've undoubtedly noticed, in the past few years, some on the right have truly lost their minds about trans rights.
But this isn't just a conservative issue. Lots of liberal feminists are outraged by transgender ideology because it reinforces regressive stereotypes about women, and it would undo the work that feminists have done to protect women being based on their identity as members of a group discriminated against because of their unique biology. For example, the feminist group Women's Liberation Front said in a brief before the Supreme Court, "Legally redefining female as anyone who claims to be female results in the erasure of female people as a class. If, as a matter of law, anyone can be a woman, then no one is a woman, and sex-based protections in the law have no meaning whatsoever." They've also been joined by people like J.K. Rowling, who's the author of the Harry Potter series. She certainly doesn't consider herself a conservative, but she believes that feminism can't be a coherent concept if the definition of what a woman is totally up for grabs.
J.K. Rowling is defending herself after making controversial transgender comments, then followed up with another tweet that reads, "If sex isn't real, there's no same-sex attraction. If sex isn't real, the lived reality of women globally is erased. I know and love trans people, but erasing the concept of sex removes the ability of many to meaningfully discuss their lives. It isn't hate to speak the truth."
Finally, many of them see transgender identities as an offensive parody of womanhood. They point out how people like Caitlyn Jenner and other transgender women, who are really men pretending to be women, that their idea of womanhood is a caricature. Women wear high heels and revealing dresses and long hair and speak in a falsetto voice. That's the essence of a woman to them.
Day 66, being a girl, and today I'm in nature. Trees, I love them. Water, lakes, I love them. Heels, they're my hiking heels. I love them. Okay, come on.
Ironically, transgender advocates are some of the biggest proponents of rigid gender stereotypes. Instead of recognizing there are sensitive boys who don't conform to masculine stereotypes, and aggressive girls, or tom girls, who don't conform to feminine stereotypes, transgender advocates slot everyone into narrow identities, and anyone who doesn't fit into those narrow identities must actually be transgender, which is a stunted and harmful view of the human person, with all of its rich psychological and cultural complexity.
This year alone, over 100 anti-trans bills have been introduced in state houses, and 12 states have signed or enacted them, with all of this happening against a backdrop of violence and threats, including attacks and harassment aimed at hospitals providing gender-affirming care to youth.
This is in response to the Twitter account Libs of TikTok, posting an audio clip of an employee at Children's National Hospital in Washington saying that they perform hysterectomies on children under the age of 18. Here's the clip.
I was calling for information about gender affirming hysterectomies.
Okay, so gender affirming hysterectomy.
I've been in touch with quite a few hospitals, and a lot of them, well, they said they won't do it for my 16-year-old. And then I was told that this hospital might, and I also saw it on your website. So if you guys do it for a 16-year-old, I would be happy for, you know, to come for a consultation or whatever it takes.
Let me get you over to the operator, and I hate to transfer you.
I just want to know if you guys do service that age, you know, before coming all the way for an in-person consult and going through all the paperwork and everything.
Yeah, it depends. And each department is different. Some departments cut off at 18. How old is your patient?
16.
Okay. All right. So they're in the clear. I'll email got the call and see what we can do.
Also, according to Oliver, it's wrong to point out what these children's hospitals are doing because some people might take violent action against them. But it isn't wrong, apparently, to disclose the private addresses of Supreme Court justices who voted to overturn Roe, even if some people might take violent action against them. In fact, one man did try to do that, and thank God the police stopped him. Look, I totally oppose threats of violence, even threats made against people who are committing violence, like abortionists or so-called gender-affirming care physicians. But I also fully support bringing to light what these people are doing. Ephesians 5:11 says, "Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness. Rather, expose them." And when they are exposed, these people hide like cockroaches when the light is turned on. For example, in October of 2022, Vanderbilt University Medical Center publicly stated that, quote, "We are pausing gender affirmation surgeries on patients under 18. In August of 2022, Boston Children's Hospital deleted a part of their website that said a person who is 17 years old could qualify for a vaginoplasty, which creates a hole in the person's pelvic region that is supposed to simulate a vagina. The hospital later claimed 17-year-olds can only qualify for a consultation, not surgery. But this doesn't explain what they originally said, which is this. To qualify for gender affirmation at Boston Children's Hospital, you must be at least 18 years old for phalloplasty or medidioplasty, and at least 17 years old for vaginoplasty. So 17-year-olds can get a consultation for vaginoplasty, but not a phalloplasty? Come on. They're just trying to spin this to cover up what they're doing, since honest people recognize this as the mutilation of children, not healthcare.
And frustratingly, there are many on the left who seem at best reluctant to engage on this issue, and at worst, outright hostile to it, either complaining about pronoun police or arguing that this issue will cost Democrats elections.
If you go to the middle of the country, people would say, if your conversation during a presidential election is about some guy wearing a dress and whether he, she, or it can go to and go to the locker room with their daughter, that's not a winning formula for most people.
Wow. It. Michael Bloomberg could all the way off with that. But
Michael Bloomberg is right. Well, that felt weird. Anyways, this is a 2021 article from Yahoo entitled, "Here's Why Some LGBTQ Youth Are Now Embracing the Non-Binary Pronoun It, Its." And the pronouns get even more bizarre than that. According to a September 2022 article in The Atlantic, quote, "In first grade, students are introduced to gender pronouns through the children's book They, She, He, Easy as ABC. The somewhat familiar pronoun Z is introduced, as are more bespoke possibilities. On one page, quote, Diego drums and dances. Tree has all the sounds. Tree is Diego's preferred pronoun. For a character named Sky, all of the pronouns are right. Soon, students are prompted to choose their own pronouns. Whatever pronouns you pick today, you can always change, the script for the teacher states. And here is a clip of someone who runs the channel Woke Kindergarten, who obviously supports this stuff, reading from the book They, She, He, Easy as ABC.
Diego drums and dances. Tree has all the sounds. So notice, when I'm reading this book, you see the words that are in different colors? Those are different pronouns that these kids like to be called. So this kid, Corey, likes to be called she, and this kid Diego likes to be called tree. There are so many different pronouns, and they're all so creative.
So yeah, the pronoun stuff in schools, it's gotten completely out of hand.
A few years ago, Vice profiled a girl named Kai Shapley, and just watch how happy she is talking about her hopes for her future until she remembers something that changes her mood.
Mom says I might grow up to be the president.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. What would you change about the world if you were president?
That chance people be free and go to the bathroom they want to go to.
Are you able to use the girls' bathroom at school?
No. And now they just put security guards up for the bathroom security or whatever. Oh, I hate that.
That is brutal. It is so dark, it's genuinely hard to watch, which would also coincidentally be a pretty accurate tagline for House of the Dragon.
It is tragic if someone struggles with any kind of identity disorder. But the answer to help people who struggle with these disorders is not to destroy all distinctions between men and women and to facilitate their disordered identity. The answer are accommodations like unisex bathrooms, which is what we used to call all gender bathrooms. The alternative leads to far more than just men and women's bathrooms. It includes men and women's locker rooms, men who sometimes expose their genitalia to other women and girls. Here are just a few examples of this happening because of transgender ideology.
Situation started in the girls' locker room. At least one volleyball player was vocal about feeling uncomfortable that a transgender athlete from the team is in the changing area with the other girls. The school put a pause on the team's use of the space while it investigates.
A local transgender woman has won a discrimination settlement with an East County gym.
The case was taken on by the ACLU after Kristen Wood was denied access to the women's facilities at Crunch Fitness in El Cajon.
Brought my paperwork out here to show them. And was immediately told, no, not quite so fast, have you? And they pointed at my nether regions and said, have you had the surgery yet?
What are you hoping comes from this?
That nobody else goes through this.
Lisa wasn't the only one who noticed. One woman took this picture.
You can clearly see in the picture, you can clearly see in person that it's a man. I mean, there's no doubt it's a man.
When Lisa walked by the person, she was dressed. Another woman was not.
Because the man was actually just in the sauna and the girl was in the shower and had proceeded to walk out of the shower naked, and the guy was right there.
Lisa and the other women walked over.
So she approached the man and said, why are you here? And he said, look at my license, I'm a female. And the girl said, and I said, you're not really a female, you look like a man.
It's okay for a man to go into the women's section, show his penis around the other women, young little girls underage. Your spa, we spa, condone that. Is that what you're saying? Like I asked. It's so he can stay there. He can stay there? What sexual orientation? I see a dick. It lets me know he's a man. He's a man.
Once again, we should have compassion towards people with identity disorders. But that does not mean we should just pretend there are no obvious biological distinctions between men and women, and that we can't identify whether someone is a man or a woman based on biology. And because of this, this necessitates segregating men and women in certain circumstances, like bathrooms or locker rooms.
Let's talk about the latest round of attacks on trans rights, where it's coming from and what it's doing. And before we begin, we're going to be taking the arguments behind a lot of these anti-trans bills seriously because of what they're doing, but not sincerely. Because so often, they seem to be based more on political calculation than what is actually happening. A pretty good example of this is that in recent years, 18 states have passed laws aimed at protecting youth sports. And South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem even made her state's bill a centerpiece of a campaign ad.
In South Dakota, only girls play girls' sports. Why? Because of Governor Kristi Noem's leadership. Noem has been protecting girls' sports for years and never backed down. Now, Governor Noem has a bill that will give South Dakota the strongest law in the nation protecting female sports. Doing the work, delivering results. Governor Kristi Noem.
Okay, if you time traveled here from the past and the first thing you saw was this ad, you would think two things. One, wow, the campaign centers around youth sports, I guess literally every other problem in America has been solved.
So notice that when a conservative politician focuses on one issue, they're being narrow-minded and neglect every other problem in America. But when liberal politicians focus on just one issue, like so-called transphobia, then they're being heroic and they're standing up for people's rights.
People like Noam love stoking fear over the specter of trans athletes, girls specifically, having an unfair advantage and taking away scholarship opportunities. But there are vanishingly few examples nationwide of trans athletes attempting to compete at all. And in Noam State specifically, the head of their high school sports association could name exactly one transgender female athlete who competed and who graduated several years ago. So there are more athletes in this shot from Noam's ad than there are trans girls known to have competed in South Dakota schools. But even if there were more, discriminating against them would still obviously be wrong. And it would still be weird that state legislatures were getting involved in decisions that are usually made by organizations governing the sports in question.
What's funny is that Oliver immediately undermines himself by saying this isn't a big issue because there's hardly any trans female athletes. But then he says even if there were a lot of transgender athletes, forcing them to compete against their own biological sex would be wrong. So which is it? The fact is, there are many examples of trans athletes competing at the high school, college, and professional levels. And you can see this when you look at LGBT magazines and other sources that profile transgender athletes. Here are some examples from recent years of transgender athletes dominating the competition profiled in major media outlets.
Canadian transgender athlete is facing a backlash after winning the Cycling World Championship. Rachel McKinnon, who was born male, finished first in the race in Los Angeles this Sunday, becoming the first ever transgender woman to win gold in the competition.
And now, making her way to the cage, please welcome Fallon Fox.
I don't expect the fight to end in a bloodbath.
These girls are getting right into it. Fox delivering the knees, and that's it. Fallon Fox, holy cow. Game over.
It took 4 minutes and 33 seconds for Leah Thomas to swim her way into NCAA history. With her victory in the women's 500-yard freestyle, Leah Thomas is now the first openly transgender D1 athlete to become an NCAA national champion. After spending 3 years on the men's team, the University of Pennsylvania swimmer surpassed the NCAA requirement to compete on the women's team, 12 months of hormone replacement therapy. Still, her standout season has ushered in a wave of scrutiny, splitting her teammates, some writing public letters of support and others anonymously speaking out against Thomas.
When was the first time that either of you found any kind of opposition to you participating on the girls' team?
I was expecting it, so every day I'll go home, search up track and field high school, Terry Miller.
Because you wanted to know what people were saying.
Yeah.
Some of those comments were harsh. Critics complaining that Andrea and Terry both have an unfair advantage since they were born boys.
At what point do you decide, actually, it's more appropriate for me to be on the girls' team and competing with other girls?
I decided that the summer before ninth grade.
Moreover, the state is routinely involved in regulating sports to make sure players aren't discriminated against. For example, the 1964 Civil Rights Act prohibited sports leagues from excluding black players. The 1972 Title IX Amendment required states to equally support men and women's sports. It's good to not arbitrarily deny women the ability to engage in sports. But these advocates say that sexism still exists if more than 50% of athletes are men, even if women don't desire to compete in those particular sports. Here's a clip from a John Stossel report on how Title IX rules negatively affect men and how this is tolerated in order to benefit women.
President Nixon signed Title IX, which says no person shall, on the basis of sex, be subjected to discrimination. Government can create equality. Under Title IX, athletic participation is supposed to be sex proportionate. So if 50% of the students are women, 50% of the athletes better be women, or a school may get sued. So schools protect themselves by cutting boys' teams.
The university cut the wrestling program over Title IX.
JMU no longer has a swim team. It's one of 10 teams the school is cutting.
Men's programs at other schools, like track and field and cross country at the University of Delaware, have been axed in the name of Title IX.
Now, I'm sure someone like Oliver would say, this is worth the cost to men because government has an interest in making sure female athletes are treated fairly. But the same argument can be made of making sure that women can compete fairly, even if it is disappointing to men who identify as women to not allow them to compete with actual women. The whole point of why we have men and women's sports is to prevent women from being shut out of sports. In many sports, if there were no women's league, women would never be featured because men simply have an undeniable biological advantage due to things like their increased muscle mass and larger bone density. What this means is that you can't consistently defend segregating biological sexes in professional sports, but then allow people to compete against the other biological sex just because they identify as that sex.
And it is worth knowing, even at the elite level, conversations around this aren't being handled with flat-out bans. The IOC has announced that it will set rules on a sport-by-sport basis, but working on the general principle that no athlete should be excluded from competition on the assumption of an advantage due to their gender. And it is pretty remarkable that a trans athlete could theoretically compete in the Olympics, but not in South Dakota under 12 soccer, a sport that genuinely only exists to obliterate parents' weekends. And state's blunt force approach has led to absurd situations like that of Mac Beggs, who, as a Texas high schooler, wanted to wrestle boys, but was forced by state rules to wrestle girls. When he won a state championship, lawmakers tried to pass a law that would have made it impossible for athletes like him to compete, period, which is obviously absurd because, as one of the wrestlers that Mac actually defeated pointed out, none of these people seem to think through the reality of Mac's situation.
Do you really honestly think someone would change their entire gender just so they would win state? No, that's not how it works.
Right. This obviously wasn't an effort to cheat. Kids aren't plotting big, deceitful, school sports-related cheating schemes just to get what they want. You're thinking of Lori Loughlin. That's who you're thinking of here.
First, people do all kinds of crazy things to win sports. Think about training regimens, crash diets, dangerous plans to lose weight in order to make a better weight class for competition. So I don't put it past someone who will do whatever it takes to win, even if it means claiming to have a transgender identity that you can always change back at a later time by saying you're gender fluid. But even if a person sincerely believes he or she is a man or a woman, the problem is that this person has an often unfair advantage because of their actual biological sex, or in some cases, because of what they are doing in order to try and change their gender. For example, one of the criticisms of Beggs was that she was taking testosterone as part of her so-called gender therapy, which would give her an advantage. Now, Beggs claimed she was taking hormone blockers to nullify the effects of the testosterone. But then, if that were true, then why bother taking the testosterone at all if you're just going to nullify all of the effects? But the main concern in allowing cross-sex competition is not girls dominating boys' sports, like in the Beggs example. It's boys dominating girls' sports by saying they're transgender women. So it's disingenuous for Oliver to focus on this one case and avoid the real problem involving men who say they're women, like NCAA swimmer Leah Thomas.
A related tactic is arguing that the rise in kids identifying as trans is due to social contagion, that it's just a mass delusion, a trendy fad that is rapidly spreading among young people. Just listen to Abigail Schreier, a vocal proponent of that theory, laying all of this out.
If you want to see brainwashed, check out these young teenagers who suddenly decide they're transgender. They immediately cut off their families. They very often drop out of school. They are very often start tattooing themselves and using drugs. And they are creating a world for themselves that is so healthy, so built around sexuality, and they lose all their hobbies. Their only hobby is being transgender.
Oh, okay. So there is a lot there, but let me just address the claim that trans kids lose all their hobbies, because I will point out that when they try to have some, like, I don't know, school sports, for example, a bunch of asshole adults try to keep them from doing it. Schreier sometimes dresses her argument up by using the term rapid onset gender dysphoria, which is total It comes from a study published by a researcher in 2018, hypothesizing that some kids identify as trans due to peer pressure. But it's worth you knowing, that study was based on a survey of parents, not actual trans kids, and it targeted parents from organizations dedicated to opposing trans ideology, which is instantly disqualifying. It's like citing a study claiming that all postal workers are terrifying hell demons sent to attack your family, but then learning that the researchers only surveyed a collection of anxious dogs. That's some heavy sampling bias that clearly skewed your results.
First, Oliver's argument will come back to haunt him. Because if you should dismiss studies because of a sampling bias in favor of the conclusion, then you have to throw out the studies that are used to defend giving hormones to transgender teenagers. Because those studies recruit people through transgender rights organizations, or the participants are self-selected. For example, one letter to the editor writing in a journal called Archives of Sexual Behavior says the following. This survey used convenience sampling, a methodology which generates low-quality data. Specifically, the participants were recruited through transgender advocacy organizations, and subjects were asked to pledge to promote the survey among friends and family. This recruiting method yielded a large but highly skewed sample. While Turbin et al. Acknowledged that the USTS may not be representative of the U.S. transgender population, they treat it as a valid source of data for major policy recommendations, disregarding the significant bias in the underlying data. You can find more analysis of the flaws in these kinds of studies in the article, The Distortions in Jack Turbin's Psychology Today article on gender-affirming care, published by Lior Sapir at the blog Reality's Last Stand. And second, there is a lot of evidence that transgender identity is often temporary in teenagers, and that children are more likely to identify as transgender if they have friends who identify this way, or if they consume social media content focusing on this issue. The 2018 study Oliver mentions is still useful because you can't get reliable results on whether teenagers are doing something because of peer pressure by asking the teenagers themselves, because they'll just cover up the peer pressure. Lots of data confirms this phenomenon, and major medical organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics refuse to publish people like Michael Biggs, who writes for the Society for Evidence-Based Medicine, in calling out this flawed research. The reality of this social trend is so obvious that even liberals like Bill Maher can see it for the punchline that it is.
Broken down over time, the LGBT population of America seems to be roughly doubling every generation. According to a recent Gallup poll, less than 1% of Americans born before 1946, that's Joe Biden's generation, identify that way. 2.6% of boomers do, 4.2% of Gen X, 10.5% of millennials, and 20.8% of Gen Z. Which means if we follow this trajectory, we will all be gay in 2054.
And to be very clear, there is ample evidence of gender variance throughout human history. And as far back as historians have found evidence of trans people, they found trans children.
There have always been people who have suffered from gender identity disorders. But there has never been a society that believed men could be pregnant or that men can become women and vice versa. That's not the issue. The issue is, how do we explain that there are three times as many people identifying as transgender between the ages of 13 and 17 in comparison to adults in general, and that this number has doubled in the past 5 years? Even people within the LGBT community recognize this problem. They call people who make transgender claims like these trans trenders, that they're just trying to be hip. Now, one response to explain the data is just that people now feel more comfortable identifying as transgender. And so the only change is people being more open to discuss how they feel, and there is no social contagion. Here's Oliver making that argument.
As for the rapid rise in kids identifying as trans, as the writer Julia Serrano has pointed out, when you look at a chart of left-handedness among Americans over the 20th century, you see a massive spike when we stopped forcing kids to write with their right hand, and then a plateau. That doesn't mean everyone became left-handed or that there was a rapid onset Southpaw dysphoria. It means people were free to be who they were. And to the extent that some young people are just exploring their gender identity, how exactly is that a bad thing? Who the are they hurting?
First, even if it were shown that the social contagion theory were true, John Oliver wouldn't care, because to him, it doesn't matter. You should be free to explore your sexuality, and it doesn't matter what causes you to have certain feelings or desires, as long as you engage in consensual behavior based on those feelings or your identity. He has to have this view because he can't say transgender identity or sexual orientation is this fixed, immutable trait, because that would be discriminatory against people who identify as gender fluid and say that their gender identity can change over time. Number two, Oliver has not disproven the social contagion theory, not by a long shot. We have more data to explain this when it comes to left-handedness, for example, because we can see left-handedness being at the same level in the population before and after dips in self-identification in the early 20th century. Also, the population that identified as left-handed tripled over the course of 60 years. So it doesn't become prominent until several generations later of people growing up in societies that have more ways to tolerate left-handedness. But when it comes to teens identifying as transgender, this is an entirely different trajectory. First, prior to social media, gender dysphoria manifested before puberty, not after, and it was primarily seen in boys who thought they were girls. But in the age of social media, there's an unprecedented number of teen girls who have hit puberty who now identify as boys, but they also suffer from other mental illnesses like clinical depression, which supports the theory that many of these diagnoses are caused by social contagion. According to Leo Sapir, what Oliver doesn't tell his audience is that the rate of transgender identification among youth has risen by a factor of between 150 and 1,050. Using the DSM-5 statistics for adults listed in 2013 and a recent Gallup poll as metrics, and depending on the respondent's sex. Even if we assume that gender dysphoria was severely underdiagnosed in youth by 2013, and the true rate was 10 times higher, and we have no reason to believe this was the case, that would still yield an increase of between 15 and 105 times the previous rate. And remember, this happened over the course of less than a decade, not as with left-handedness, 60 years. And here is what the French Academy of Medicine has said about the reality of transgender social contagion. Whatever the mechanisms involved in adolescence, excessive engagement with social media, greater social acceptability, or influence by those in one's social circle, this epidemic-like phenomenon manifests itself in the emergence of cases or even clusters of cases in the adolescent's immediate surroundings. This primarily social problem is due, in part, to the questioning of an overly dichotomous view of gender identity by some young people. There is no test to distinguish between persisting gender dysphoria and transient adolescent dysphoria. Moreover, the risk of overdiagnosis is real, as evidenced by the growing number of young adults wishing to detransition.
Watching the conversation around this, it is hard not to feel like, to the extent that there is any social contagion here, it is among adults who have whipped themselves into such a frenzy that they can find themselves repeating some humiliating nonsense. Perhaps the stupidest of which is a new talking point about what accommodating children's gender identity has led to.
I even heard from one person here recently said that a student identified as a cat and wanted a litter box.
They think they're a cat. A cat. They put tails on and they demand that they have a litter box in the school.
We've literally got kids who think they're cats and dogs using litter boxes in classrooms.
I'm still hearing from students and parents, they believe there is a litter box in that school. And when everybody will turn the other cheek to allegations, a rumor is just a rumor until it becomes true.
The fact you seem to genuinely think that that's happening is just heartbreakingly stupid. Because when you think about it, for literally 2 seconds, the whole thing falls apart. For one, if kids were using litter boxes in class, a state representative from Minnesota would not be the one breaking that news to you. You would have heard about it. If a kid in a litter box in first period, it would be the only thing anyone in that state was talking about by lunch.
Now, this example shows we need to make sure we have evidence to back up our claims and not repeat stories that sound true or conform to our biases. So it appears the claim that schools have put out litter boxes for students who identify as cats is false. The school where the Columbine shooting took place had kitty litter in classrooms in case students needed to go to the bathroom during a school-wide lockdown. But no school has been shown to put out kitty litter for students who identify as cats or any other kind of animal. Now, that being said, there is a growing movement of people who identify as non-human animals. You might say, well, that's silly, that's slippery slope, that's never going to catch on. But you probably would have said the same thing about Drag Queen Story Hour and transgender surgery on children back in the 1990s. Here's a few examples.
A woman in Norway believes she belongs to a different breed. She claims that she is a cat trapped in a human's body.
Maya Okami may look like a human, but she identifies as a wolf. And she joins us now live from her home in Seattle.
I am a 27-year-old transgender woman. I am a Wolftherian and a member of the furry fandom.
I am Tiamat Legion Medusa, and I am a genderless dragon. I was born a male. When I look in the mirror, I see a creature. I don't see a human.
Finally, when you go to the website Ask a Non-Binary on Tumblr, you find dozens of pronouns, including ones for people who identify with nature, like moon self, animals like meow self, and even fantasy creatures like mer self for those who identify as mermaids.
So much of the fear of and arguments against transgender people seems to flow from misinformation and misunderstanding, and maybe the biggest and most dangerous area of ignorance surrounds the concept of gender-affirming care. In recent years, four states have enacted bans or restrictions on youth access to it, and over a dozen more have considered similar legislation this year alone. And they have been fueled by a lack of basic knowledge about what gender-affirming care actually consists of.
Actually, it's not just states in the U.S. that are suspending gender-affirming care for minors. Several countries in Europe are also prohibiting this kind of care for minors, because it involves lifelong, irreversible effects that children of this age cannot consent to. Here are a few examples, the first of which coming from England. The only clinic in the country that does this gender care is now scheduled to be closed because of the massive amount of lawsuits being made against it for rushing kids into gender care.
Now, the High Court has ruled that children under 16 who say they want to change gender are unlikely to be able to give their informed consent to treatment with drugs that block puberty. The case was brought by a young woman who regretted her decision to have treatment and argued that a court order should be needed for children to take the medication.
Now, England's only dedicated gender identity clinic for children and young people is about to close. A decade ago, the Tavistock Clinic was helping 250 children, but the past year saw 5,000 referrals.
Now, the Tavistock Gender Clinic will be closed down after a review found it was not safe for children. You warned about these very dangers in your best-selling book, The Madness of Crowds.
But to say, you know, if you feel a little bit left out or a bit strange in your body sometimes, and who doesn't feel strange in puberty, but if you feel a bit strange in your body, maybe you're the opposite sex, and maybe you can just get those developing breasts lopped off. Or we can do a double mastectomy on totally healthy young women and much more. You know, that is wicked.
And the same thing can be seen in countries like Sweden and Finland that refuse to provide hormone therapy to nearly all teenagers seeking it.
So let's break down exactly what gender-affirming care consists of, because in younger children, it can mean nothing more than a social transition, like calling them by a new name, or giving them a new haircut, or clothing, or providing them with psychological or behavioral support.
This intervention might not use surgery or chemicals, but it can still have lifelong effects, because you're reinforcing a mistaken sense of identity, a delusion, in the mind of a young child who doesn't have a full grasp of reality. Here is Matt Walsh raising this point in a disturbing interview with a so-called gender-affirming care specialist.
Have you ever met a four-year-old who believes in Santa Claus?
Mm-hmm.
So this is someone who believes that a fat man is traveling through the sky on a flying reindeer at lightning speed, coming down his chimney with presents.
Yeah.
Would you say that this is someone who maybe has a tenuous grasp on reality?
They have an appropriate four-year-old handle on the reality.
Agreed.
That's very real for them.
Agreed. Agreed. But Santa Claus is real for them, but
yeah.
Santa Claus is not actually real.
Yeah, well, but Santa Claus does deliver their Christmas presents.
Well, yeah, but he's not real, though.
To that child, they are.
When I see a child who, you know, believes in Santa Claus, and then let's say this is a boy and he says, I'm a girl.
Mm-hmm.
This is someone who can't distinguish between fantasy and reality. So how could you take that as a reality?
I would say that as a pediatrician and as a parent, I would say how wonderful my four-year-old in their imagination is.
By constantly telling a child he or she belongs to the other sex, you are emotionally abusing them, just as it would be emotionally abusive to constantly peddle any other lie that confuses the child about his or her personal identity.
Because to be very clear, prepubescent children are not eligible for medical interventions. Now, at the onset of puberty, an adolescent and their family might consider puberty blockers, hormones that delay puberty. And importantly, if that treatment is suspended, then puberty will resume, meaning that this is reversible. Think of it like a pause button, the thing you can't do easily on the HBO Max app.
Notice that Oliver contradicts himself. He says prepubescent children are not eligible for medical interventions. But the whole point of puberty blockers is to stop puberty from happening. So you're giving these medications to young children, not older teenagers who've already gone through most of puberty. And the claim that they are reversible is a lie that has caused untold amounts of damage to vulnerable teenagers. I mean, think about it. Your body is not a video game or a Netflix show that you can just pause and unpause. Pausing your body is more like revving the gas in your car while you have the car in park. Now, it's not going to be good on the engine if you do that for years on end. Think about what it would do to a teenager's body. The fact of the matter is, we don't know what the long-term effects are when it comes to these drugs. That's probably why the British NHS and the New Zealand Ministry of Health both removed language from their websites saying puberty blockers and hormone treatments were fully reversible. But one thing Oliver won't show you are stories from teens who took puberty blockers only to regret the irreversible changes they make to the body.
Questions about how and whether children should be able to reassign their gender. Children like Kira Bell, who never imagined her story would lead her here.
I'm delighted at the judgment of the court today. It was a judgment that will protect vulnerable people. I wish it had been made for me before I embarked on the devastating experiment of puberty blockers. My life would be very different today.
Kira was 16 when she went to the Tavistock Centre. She started receiving hormone blockers and later surgery to become Quincy. She regretted the decision. And today, in a landmark ruling, a judge said her case had shown it's doubtful 14 and 15-year-olds could understand long-term risks of treatment, and highly unlikely children under 13 can give competent consent.
I was extremely upset and, just realising how traumatic the experience was and how deceitful I feel that the clinicians were during my care. It was heartbreaking. Medical transition doesn't have to be the way for you. You know, you can come out of this the other end.
Now, the next potential medical intervention is usually hormone therapy, which boosts levels of testosterone or estrogen. Opponents of gender-affirming care make a lot of alarmist claims about hormone therapy, from saying that it's experimental, which it is not, to arguing that it sterilizes people. And look, for some, in specific situations, there can be risks to fertility, but for others, the effect is anticipated to be reversible if the medication is discontinued. But there is definitely an informed decision to be made there.
Hormone therapy was traditionally used to help children who have a rare condition called precocious puberty. These therapies would help children whose development was going too fast, like developing secondary sex characteristics in children under the ages of 8 and 9. But it was never used to pause healthy development in teenagers who have a normal cycle of puberty. That's where it's untested in how it's being used. And countries in Europe that I mentioned earlier, like Finland, Sweden, England, they've stopped this treatment in minors because their own research showed it's not healthy for children. One major children's hospital in Sweden released this statement. In December 2019, the SBU published an overview of the knowledge base, which showed a lack of evidence for both the long-term consequences of the treatments and the reasons for the large influx of patients in recent years. These treatments are potentially fraught with extensive and irreversible adverse consequences, such as cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, infertility, increased cancer risk, and thrombosis. This makes it challenging to assess the risk-benefit for the individual patient, and even more challenging for the minors and their guardians to be in a position of an informed stance regarding these treatments. Dr. Hilary Cass, the former president of the Royal College of Pediatrics and Child Health in England, wrote the following in a letter to the country's National Institute of Health. A further concern is that adolescent sex hormone surges may trigger the opening of a critical period for experience-dependent rewiring of neural circuits underlying executive function, i.e. maturation of the part of the brain concerned with planning, decision-making, and judgment. If this is the case, brain maturation may be temporarily or permanently disrupted by puberty blockers, which could have significant impact on the ability to make complex, risk-laden decisions, as well as possible longer-term neuropsychological consequences. To date, there has been very limited research on the short, medium, or longer-term impact of puberty blockers on neurocognitive development. So this is not a case of just ignorant conservatives in the U.S., as Oliver would have you believe. Instead, the social democracies Oliver no doubt idolizes in Europe actually follow the science, and while they still engage in disturbing practices that promote transgender ideology, they recognize that it is irresponsible to allow children to make decisions that have such high permanent costs and no corresponding benefit to their health.
And you will notice that none of what I've mentioned so far is surgery. But when it does come to that, some teens may be eligible, for instance, for top surgery or chest masculinization. But you should know, not only is that pretty rare, it, like all of this, would only happen after a team of medical professionals discussed all of its risks and benefits with their patient and their patient's parent or guardian, all of whom would have to sign off. It is a long, involved process even before you get to the fact that it's also incredibly expensive, which is why working class families, families of color, and people with less resources are way less able to access it. Basically, no kid is casually dropping into an operating room because they just decided to get their uterus removed with the impulsive recklessness normally associated with getting bangs. Because that is an absolutely ridiculous thing to say.
Notice that Oliver tries to downplay surgery for minors, but he ends up admitting that some teenage girls can get chest masculinization, which is a euphemism for amputating a girl's healthy breasts. What's really ironic about all of this is that most plastic surgeons say that a teenage girl should not get breast implants. She should wait until she's at least 18 years old. And several authors have said the government should ban breast implants for minors, because even when parents consent to them, the parents may still not be acting in the child's best interest. But when it comes to removing healthy breasts, which is even more irreversible than getting breast implants, suddenly this is something that any decision that a young person can make. Keep in mind that even after you reach the age of 18, these procedures are still evil acts of mutilation that ought to be illegal. I remember reading one article about a man who got a synthetic vagina, which is really just a hole in his pelvic region, that was constantly at risk of infection because his body was trying to heal this artificial hole that had been put into it. Doctors that advise and perform gender surgeries even admit that the surgeries can leave someone without the ability to ever feel sexual pleasure.
Every single child who was, or adolescent who was truly blocked at Tanner stage two has never experienced orgasm. I mean, it's really about zero. These are just assigned male at birth, so trans feminine. And it's because they never in their lives are exposed to testosterone.
There could be injury to the clitoris.
Yeah. That's the biggest thing I'm worried about.
I feel like I've already lost the aesthetics. You know, hopefully after this revision, it'll look good once it heals. But if I lose some of my sensation and nerve endings, I might never experience an orgasm.
I guess it's goodbye time.
Mm-hmm.
Until tomorrow.
Until tomorrow.
Okay. Well,
and the very notion that the state would suddenly interfere in any of this is understandably infuriating for both trans kids and their parents. Just watch this mom in Arkansas, where legislators were banning, among other things, hormone therapy for young people, describe what it did for her son, who suffered from severe depression before transitioning.
I'd say like a month to 2 months in, I started seeing that kid come back, come out of his shell, talk to us more, laugh.
What did that feel like as a mom?
It was like, that's it. This has been the answer all along. Why would anybody want to take that away from them? There's no reason why you should be butting in to my care for my child.
What do you want to say to these legislators?
Fuck you.
Right. Right. Because transitioning isn't taking your kid away from you. In some cases, it can be giving you your kid back. This is not one of those instances where it is okay to butt into someone's care for their child. This isn't Pigpen. And by the way, do you need help, Pigpen? Blink your filthy eyes if you need help, Pigpen.
So Oliver says the state has no business interfering with a parent and doctor who want to help their child change their gender. But in other episodes, Oliver has criticized conversion therapy, which uses psychological approaches between a doctor and a patient to attempt to change their sexual orientation. Now, I'm not going to weigh in on whether this is a successful approach to same-sex attraction. My point is simply that Oliver is operating under a massive double standard. Now, I'm sure he'd support banning conversion therapy because he claims that it harms minors and they aren't old enough to consent to something that would involve changing a fundamental part of their identity, like their sexual orientation. But then he says kids are mature enough to consent to procedures to change their gender, even through surgery, which is more than conversion therapy. Now, I'm sure another reason he opposes conversion therapy is that Oliver would say there's nothing wrong with being gay. But why doesn't he say the same thing about gender ideology? Why doesn't he say there's nothing wrong with being a more masculine girl or a more feminine boy? Why bother changing your gender at all? Once again, this is the fundamental problem with transgender ideology. On the one hand, they say nothing is intrinsically male or female. There's no boy or girl toys, for example. To say otherwise is a bigoted stereotype. But on the other hand, when they explain what it means to be a woman, they say, well, it means you prefer stereotypically feminine things. Girls want girl toys, girl clothes, long hair, makeup, bodies that look like female celebrities. So once again, transgender ideology is incoherent, and it's only taken seriously because gatekeepers and cultural institutions threaten the platforms and livelihoods of those who are willing to say the emperor has no clothes.
So the benefits of providing care are immense, and the risks of withholding it are dire. A survey of around 28,000 trans people found that of those who wanted hormone therapy and didn't receive it, 58% reported suicidal thoughts in a given year, which is why the three major professional associations of child and adolescent doctors, psychologists, and psychiatrists have endorsed gender-affirming care and condemned efforts to deny it.
First, these medical associations get a lot of things wrong, especially when they're dealing with a political issue. They were wrong about school closures leading to profound learning loss. They were wrong about the need for two-year-olds to wear masks during the pandemic. They were wrong about the COVID vaccine being able to prevent transmission of COVID. Heck, these children's medical organizations were wrong in the year 2000 about peanut allergies. They recommended keeping kids away from all peanuts and even breastfeeding mothers from eating peanuts until a child was at least 3 years old. And during that time period, peanut allergies doubled. So you'll forgive me if I don't really give a hoot about what these groups say about something that is just obviously bad for kids if you have a working brain. Second, the claim that denying hormone treatment to transgender teens will lead to increased suicide rates is not supported by the evidence. People who have gender dysphoria often have other mental illnesses or other dysphorias like anorexia, which also have suicide risks. In all these cases, what helps prevent suicide are not hormones, but psychotherapy and medication to treat illnesses like clinical depression. Also, puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones can cause disruptions to the body that make suicidal ideation more likely. Oxford University professor Michael Biggs says the following: there was no statistically significant difference in psychosocial functioning between the group of transgender patients given hormone blockers and the group given only psychological support. In addition, there is unpublished evidence that after a year on puberty blockers, children reported greater self-harm, and that girls experienced more behavioral and emotional problems and expressed greater dissatisfaction with their body. So puberty blockers exacerbated gender dysphoria. Finally, as Matt Walsh notes in his rebuttal, if it is true that there has been millions of transgender kids throughout history, but they've been afraid to publicly share their identity until now, which Oliver asserts, then we'd expect to have observed an epidemic of suicides throughout this population throughout history. But we don't find that. Instead, the causes of suicide tend to be other kinds of mental illnesses that we should address. And we shouldn't address them with medical interventions, so-called medical interventions like gender surgery or hormone therapy, that are more likely to cause someone to have a disturbed psyche that can lead them to making a tragically permanent decision like suicide.
And you may have seen or heard from a small subset of people who detransitioned, but it is worth knowing such cases are rare and highly individualized. Studies show an average of just 2% of people who transition express regret, and that the vast majority of those who have opted to detransition did so not because of changes in their gender identity, but due to external factors such as stigma and lack of social support.
Notice that when a group of people make Oliver's argument difficult for him, like boys competing in girls' sports or people who detransition, then Oliver says that they're really rare, highly individualized examples. But when he talks about children who persistently seek hormones or surgery because they have a permanent gender dysphoria, he doesn't mention that this is a rare group. Most children who identify as transgender stop identifying that way without any intervention. Here is Senator Rand Paul discussing this in a Senate hearing.
Dr. Levine, you have supported both allowing minors to be given hormone blockers to prevent them from going through puberty, as well as surgical destruction of a minor's genitalia. Like surgical mutilation, hormonal interruption of puberty can permanently alter and prevent secondary sexual characteristics. The American College of Pediatricians reports that 80 to 95% of prepubertal children with gender dysphoria will experience resolution by late adolescence if not exposed to medical intervention and social affirmation. Dr. Levine, do you believe that minors are capable of making such a life-changing decision as changing one's sex? The question was about minors. Let's be a little more specific since you evaded the question. Do you support the government intervening to override the parent's consent to give a child puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and/or amputation surgery of breasts and genitalia? You have said that you're willing to accelerate the protocols for street kids. I'm alarmed that poor kids with no parents who are homeless and distraught, you would just go through this and allow that to happen to a minor.
Also, the 2% figure is misleading because it comes from studies of adults who underwent gender transitioning, not teenagers. We simply don't know how many of them regret it because it's so poorly studied. And many of them may feel peer pressure and pressure from others, as well as pressure from the fact that their body has already changed, that they might as well continue to go on with this identity and not experience regret because there's no turning back now. The fact of the matter is, it's just poorly studied. This is why health organizations in Europe that support transgender ideology have prohibited these interventions for nearly all children. And you can still find high levels of mental illness and depression among LGBT populations in these European countries, despite the fact that these countries are some of the most LGBT-affirming places on the planet, which refutes Oliver's claim that regret after gender transitioning is mainly due to social stigmas.
And look, I could keep reading you stats and studies. I do, after all, love doing that. Or I could just let you watch this boy talk about what it felt like to have someone actually see him for who he was.
Dylan explained how as early as fourth grade, he'd had confusing feelings that stretched on until his teenage years.
I really wanted to cut my hair, like really bad. And so when I did that, that felt really good. And then I held the door for somebody and they said, thank you, sir. And I was like, oh yeah, that, yeah, that.
This little thing?
Little thing. That sir put words to how I was feeling and I was like, oh yeah, that felt nice.
Yeah. That's incredible. For some, a haircut is just a routine activity where you go to your barber, ask for the business in the front, business in the back, and leave. But for a trans kid, it can be a life-changing experience.
Nobody is talking about having laws that say how long or short you can cut your hair. If you want to be a boy who rocks a long ponytail or a girl with a buzz cut, that's your choice. What we are talking about is protecting children from things like schools that hide admissions of gender dysphoria from parents and push transgender ideology onto students. It's about protecting women and children from grown men who are burying their genitalia in locker rooms and saying it's okay because they identify as women. And if you really want to see the hypocrisy of this approach to transgender identity, let's compare it to another issue, child marriage. In several U.S. states, children under the age of 18 can legally marry if they have their parents' permission or permission from a judge. Here's another alleged comedian from Comedy Central, Samantha Bee, praising a teenage Girl Scouts project to try to ban marriages of girls under the age of 18 in her state.
It was 17-year-old Cassandra LeVake who learned about New Hampshire's marriage law at a Girl Scout conference. It's a law that allows girls as young as 13 and boys who are 14 to be married with the consent of a judge.
They're just going into puberty. They are just discovering things about themselves. They are not ready to discover marriage.
Cassandra, as part of a Girl Scout project, worked to craft a piece of legislation to raise the minimum age for marriage to 18.
Yeah, that sounds pretty accomplished for a Girl Scout.
So this makes sense. Kids were still trying to figure out themselves. They shouldn't make decisions that have such severe consequences like marriage. But now, here's Samantha Bee on laws prohibiting hormone therapy for minors, which is another significant decision with important consequences.
In Arizona, Governor Doug Ducey signed bills targeting trans youth, including one that would restrict access to gender-affirming health care.
We're protecting children from irreversible decisions.
If you believe Republicans who say this is about protecting kids, I have a bridge those same Republicans won't pay to fix to sell you.
What's interesting is that in some respects, marriage is more reversible than hormone therapy. Because while you can later get an annulment or a divorce, you can't undo what these chemicals have been doing to stunt the natural growth of your body. And now imagine that a defender of child marriage simply ignored all the negative effects of child marriage that have been provided by peer-reviewed studies and just said, yeah, but here's this heartfelt testimony from a 14-year-old girl who says that she loves being married. People like John Oliver would say that's manipulative cow dung, and they'd be right. Except they do the exact same thing when they trot out anecdotes from some children who identify as transgender instead of honestly looking at the data and ignoring the anecdotes from children who have been irreversibly harmed by transgender ideologues. Finally, Oliver and Bee might say child marriage is different because teens are being exploited by adults. And it's true, there's definitely cases where that happens. But guess what? Doctors who promote transgender treatments have a financial interest in doing so. And because of that, they're involved in an exploitative establishment preying on vulnerable teenagers that brings in nearly $2 billion a year.
All the kids we've seen tonight shouldn't need to be activists. They should get to dress how they want, go to the right bathroom for them, and play the sports they want to play. Remember Mac? When he got to college, he was placed on the men's wrestling team. And just look at how happy that made him.
All I ever wanted to do was wrestle men. And now that I am, it's freaking dope. It's freaking dope.
Yeah, it is freaking dope. Do you see that joy in his face? Hold that in your mind going forward, not because the road ahead isn't rough, but because, as the trans actress Michaela J. Rodriguez points out, it is important not to lose sight of what is at the end of it.
This is like arguing that abortion is okay, because here's a bunch of women saying how their abortions helped them, and they don't have any regrets. That may be true, but it doesn't tell the whole story. just as testimonies of people who regret their abortion should also be included, along with women who don't, testimonies of kids who regret their gender transitioning should be included as well. Here's just one of them.
In her 20s, Grace Ladinsky Smith was seriously depressed and developed gender dysphoria. She began searching for answers in transgender communities on the internet.
And when I saw them being so happy and excited about doing this wonderful transformative process to really like become their true selves, it was like, have I considered that this could be my situation too?
Grace says she found a gender therapist on the internet and told her, I'm thinking of transitioning. Because she was over 18 and didn't need parental consent, she says she merely signed an informed consent form at a clinic and got hormone shots. Just 4 months after she started testosterone, she says she was approved for a mastectomy, what's called top surgery, that she told us was traumatic.
I started to have a really disturbing sense that like a part of my body was missing, almost a ghost limb feeling about being like, there's something that should be there. And the feeling really surprised me, but it was really hard to deny.
And so she detransitioned by going off testosterone.
And what about the testimonies of women in sports who were sidelined by men claiming to be women? In choosing a girl claiming to be a boy and wanting to wrestle other boys, as I noted earlier, Oliver has picked a sympathetic example. And there's an argument that could be made for exceptional women to be allowed to compete against men because they have a natural talent that allows them to excel past their female peers. But in doing that, you would be recognizing an exception to the rules, not throwing out the concept of segregated sports entirely. But it looks a lot different when you have biological males claiming to be women who end up on sports teams and rob women of what they've worked so hard to achieve. Unfortunately, many of these athletes fear publicly saying this because they'll be blacklisted from university events that are controlled by transgender ideologues, which is why people like Leah Thomas's teammates who complained about her presence on the team had to do so through anonymous letters. And finally, even leaving aside all the anecdotes of people who do and don't regret any procedure, whether it's abortion or gender reassignment surgery, whatever it may be, anecdotes only tell us how people feel. We have to move past feelings and get to the objective truths about reality, such as that an unborn child is a human being and abortion is an act of violence upon that human being. Or sex is determined biologically and so-called gender reaffirming surgery is an act of violence against children, even if children supposedly consent to these procedures, which at their age, they simply can't. All right, well, I just want to thank everybody for watching today's rebuttal, and I'll leave a link below to some of the studies and resources that I cited. I just want to leave you with one last thought. Be suspicious of people who gaslight you over things that we know deep down harm children. For example, for decades, people said that divorce, it doesn't harm kids. Kids are resilient. They'll bounce back. But they had absolutely no data to support that conclusion. It was just wishful thinking being driven by people who support legal divorce. But now we do have the data, and studies show that divorce causes more emotional trauma for children than even the death of a parent. But this was swept under the rug to accommodate people advocating for divorce until the data became too large to ignore. And I think someday in the future, the same thing will happen with transgender ideology. Until then, all we can do is charitably engage the arguments of people like John Oliver and compassionately affirm the dignity of people with gender dysphoria and tell them they can have a fulfilling life apart from medical interventions that don't promise happiness and distort their true identity. But once again, thank you guys for watching, and I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.